Out 90 The Fan, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. Back again for another week of Smith and Jones. Busy weekend, no doubt about it. Hey, not just in the world, but in the world of sports as we kind of inch towards, a little bit closer towards the start of the NBA season and obviously news coming out of Major League Baseball. And as it pertains to the Toronto Blue Jays, we will discuss that over the course of the next hour. And right off the bat, before I even go to Jonesy, we want to make sure we mention and send out a big shout-out and thanks to Aaron Waxman and Associates as they begin today as the new title sponsor for our show for Smith & Jones. So again, thanks to our friends at Aaron Waxman and Associates. Jonesy, you and I had a chance earlier today to listen in on a conference call slash Zoom call with President of the Toronto Raptors, Masai Ujiri, and also Raptors point guard Fred VanVleet, as the Raptors are down in Naples, Florida, getting ready for the official training camp that starts league-wide in about a week and a half across the NBA, with the season starting on July 30th, the Raptors' first game being on August 1st. And both gentlemen, Ujiri and VanVleet, speaking today about the fact that they feel as safe and or as comfortable as possible with how things are currently unfolding for the Raptors in Florida, and still optimistic about what this bubble could look like in basically a month, and what the future potentially could look like as well for not just the Raptors, but for the NBA and the sports world in general.
Well, Eric, I think the biggest thing that I took from that is they're trying to minimize any kind of risk by looking after what they know they can look after. Fred talked about, you know, eating, working out, and, you know, playing video games and basically staying in his hotel room. And, you know, Masai also talked about entrusting Adam Silver in the NBA, and he's been on committees and stuff to do the right thing and keep everybody safe. Because, I mean, there was a tweet out last week that said, if the cases rose to the point where it became that dangerous, they would shut it down. And I don't think the NBA wants to go through that. Not that they've, not with all that they've done to get this restart going. So good to hear from, you know, Fred and from Masai, at least where the Raptors are, that they're safe. And it looks like, you know, they're keeping themselves safe. Let's see what happens when they get to Orlando.
Well, they're essentially acting as in a weird way, and I don't mean this maybe as literal as the you know, the analogy comes out, Jonesy, but they're kind of the guinea pigs in some senses. I mean, we already have sports going on overseas, specifically when we think about the Bundesliga, but, you know, we're seeing obviously, you know, the PGA, and we've seen golf events coming back, you know, including this past weekend. But as far as the four major sports in North America, the Raptors are the first to convene, and not every player is still there, and they can't work out as a group as of yet. But they are kind of the guinea pigs in terms of being the first to converge on a specific hotel, to go through the protocols of sort of being confined in one space, in one room, etc. As you just noted, doing very little outside of just sitting in your room, watching TV, playing video games, watching Netflix, going to the gym, and coming right back and sitting in your room again. And we've seen some of the guys posting on social media, you know, taking little videos from their balcony and kind of shouting across the balcony at each other and having conversations, or looking down on a coach that's doing a workout down in his room or whatnot, as I'm sure some folks might have seen with Terrence Davis and Jimmy Sand, one of the assistant coaches for the Raptors. But for the most part, you know, all eyes are kind of watching the Raptors right now to see if anything, knock on wood, negative comes out of their little mini Raptor bubble before they enter the big bubble in Orlando in the next week or so.
Well, yeah, you're right, Eric. They are a trial, and in a sense, being a trial, they're also probably trendsetters and example setters as to what, you know, as to what has to happen going forward. So everybody is watching them. And at the same time, while they're under the bubble, they need to stay prepared. I mean, Fred talked about the fact that, you know, guys are still hungry and they still want to win. And it just goes to show with NBA players, it doesn't matter where or what you're playing for. If you're playing basketball, you know, guys that want to compete are going to get after it. So I'll be interested to see what happens when the game gets going, especially with no fans in the stands. And, you know, we talked to Scott Morrison about it, and I'm going to continue to ask guys, what's it going to be like to play without drawing energy from the fans, especially a team like Toronto that has such a great home court advantage, great energy from its crowd. And I think, like I said before, I'm going to defer to guys that I would draft or I would choose on my team if we were playing pickup. You know, guys that don't care who's in the stands. It's not about how it looks. They get the job done. And, you know, you look at a guy like Fred or a guy like Kyle Lowry, you know, and people would laugh before, but there's Kyle taking charges in the All-Star game. Why? Because he wants to win. And those are the kinds of guys. And we talked to Scott Morrison about it. We look at Boston. You're darn right. I'd pick Marcus Smart on my team or Jaylen Brown or, you know, a Kemba Walker, one of those guys. The same way I'd pick Fred or Kyle or Pascal or Marc Gasol, who's maybe the ultimate pickup player, who's kind of doesn't have the physical attributes he used to have, but is playing with his mind. So it's going to be interesting once this thing gets going.
Jonesy, I don't say this or ask this naively, and there's no denying you've played at a far more significant level than I ever did. But does this kind of harken back to grade school, high school, even if you played at a small college where maybe you didn't play in front of a whole lot of fans? Or to your point, as you were just discussing, does it harken back to just playing the game as a kid or as a teenager, even as an adult, weekend warrior stuff, out on the courts, out on a pickup game? I mean, if Fred VanVleet right now were to be back home in Rockford and playing with some of his buddies, whether they be, you know, buddies from high school or buddies that even played with at some significant level in college or otherwise, if they just went up to a local court or a YMCA or some gym, like we see some of these pickup games that have taken place, especially in New York. I want to think it was at Lifetime Fitness, one of those gyms where we regularly see videos with, you know, J.R. Smith and Carmelo Anthony and Kevin Durant, James Harden, all these guys. They're not playing in front of anybody. There might be somebody standing on the sidelines shooting the video that we ultimately see on Instagram or on Twitter, but they're not playing in front of any fans. And these look like extremely intense, competitive games. And does the competitive juices just start flowing? Does the desire to win and competition just ultimately kick in for these guys? And further to that, does it also kick in that whether it's 10, 15, 20, 100 guys, fellow colleagues, fellow brethren from the league, will be sitting in the stands watching these games? As we discussed last week, Raptors could be playing the Celtics, and sitting in the stands are, you know, 10, 20, 50 current and former All-Stars, because they don't feel like sitting in their hotel room and they're in the gym. And so you're kind of feeding off that vibe and energy. And can that replicate or replace 20,000 fans?
It can, Eric, if you've got the right heart and the right mindset.
That's what because, I thought, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, the you go to a pickup run and you want to get on the court and you want to hold the court. You want to win. And, you know, the scenario you just described is very similar to an NCAA tournament where, you know, you're playing the 1 o'clock game and the team that's playing the 3 o'clock game has come to the arena in their sweats and they've come into the stands and they're sitting watching you play. They've got an eye on you and you're trying to show them, hey, we aim to win this thing. We don't know about you guys sitting up in your sweats in the stands. You might look good, but we're out here trying to get it done. So yeah, all of those things work, and it goes back to that element of playing pickup before there was any money, and that's why I think the great players are so great. They can at when they're out on the court, at times they can just forget about everything except focusing on winning. They can forget about how much money this guy's making or that guy's making. Hey, maybe that motivates them more if that guy's making more money than them. But it's the same way. You go to a pickup game I would go to a pickup game in grade school and I'm playing against a guy who's a college all-star and I'm a high school kid in the pickup game. Mm-hmm. You don't think I want to show him something? And it's the same kind of that same stuff just flows through the whole basketball community. So I will be very interested to see how it shakes down when it all comes out.
Hey, listen, I'll just say this, and listen, we could probably do an entire hour on this, Jonesy. Everybody has their weekend warrior story or you know, they played in a pickup game, whether it be basketball or football or hockey or baseball or otherwise. to think of the intensity and the seriousness and how much we want to win. Let's just use our own examples, and maybe I'm telling a couple of stories out of school here, but I can think over the years in our 15 years of traveling together, some pickup basketball games we've played on the road in certain hotels that have had gyms, whether it be in Washington or Boston, where the Swirsk back in the day got his hip split open, you know, trying to come through a hard screen. Our old director, Troy Clary, getting clocked in the head by Sherm Hamilton by accident, took a big goose egg and cut to his head. Johnny Russin, stats man on the TV side, going full tilt into a brick wall, getting cut open in the middle of his forehead, trying to go from a Matt Devlin touchdown pass. Sam Mitchell pulling my finger out of its socket, my left baby finger, and dislocating my finger. The jaw jacking that I went on with you and other folks on the basketball ops side, where we're, you know, it's the competitive fire. So I feel like these guys, as pro athletes, still making millions, they're going to want to win and bring it no matter who's in the crowd, whether it's 20 people or 20,000 people. They're going to want to win, and they're going to want to win every time they step out there, no matter who is bearing witness.
And that's what makes the game what it is. You know, the finals are great, and they're competitive, and they're intense, and there's millions of people watching around the world. But to the guys out on the floor, you play to win. In the famous words of Herman Edwards, you play to win the game. And it doesn't matter who's out there. It doesn't matter who's watching. You're trying to win. And whatever it takes that needs to be done to win, they're going to do it. So I'm really looking forward, because you can bet guys are going to be a little bit hungrier too after this restart gets going.
All right, joining us later on this hour, Ben Wagner, the voice of the Toronto Blue Jays, right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We'll talk about things as it relates to Major League Baseball and the Blue Jays specifically, as we are still awaiting official confirmation from the Canadian government that the Jays will indeed be allowed to come up here and not only have camp in Toronto, but then have half of their 60 games played in Toronto. We'll talk to Ben Wagner about that later on. But on the line right now, national NBA writer for Bleacher Report, Howard Beck. Howard, how you doing today?
Hey, good afternoon, guys. How are you?
Doing well, Howard.
Good, Howard.
Doing well. Howard, let me ask you. We Jonesy and I just spent the first 10 minutes or so here talking about, again, the NBA. We're essentially a month away from the first game, July 30th, the Raptors playing on August 1st. At this point, just as of today, before camps have even opened, Howard, how comfortable are you with what the NBA has put in place, the plan, and how effective, ultimately, you think it can or will be?
Well, I will say it's probably not relevant whether I'm comfortable with it. I mean, the most important thing is that, you know, the 300 some odd players who are going are comfortable with it, that the staffs who are going are comfortable with it, that all the other personnel, the referees. And on top of that, you know, I'll leave it to the epidemiologists. And, you know, most of the reporting in the wake of the NBA unveiling its plans has had epidemiologists generally giving them good marks, saying, you know what, there's no perfect plan. There's no plan that's risk-free. But this is solid. They've done a good job. This has a reasonable chance of working. All that said, you know, my perspective, for what it's worth, it doesn't look great when cases are spiking as badly as they are around Florida, and in particular in Orange County, Florida, where the NBA is going to be setting up camp for a few months. And I wonder how much worse it might get. I also wonder, as I asked Adam Silver on the conference call on Friday, you know, and it's not a question he could answer, but I had to ask, you know, would you go there if you knew it was going to be this bad? And is there a threshold beyond which you should not be there? How bad do the cases have to spike? How bad does the spread have to be before the NBA decides that maybe this is not worth the risk? Now, I think this train is just moving. I don't think you're stopping it at this point. I think they're going regardless. I think this is happening regardless. But at some point, the optics and or the logistics could become untenable. That seems like that's within the realm of possibility. But you hope for the best at this point.
Howard, how bad does it look if they have to shut it down again?
Obviously terrible if they have to shut it down again, but not as bad as it would look for someone to get terribly ill or die, you know, as a result of this. And it's not just NBA personnel. There's all the Disney staff who are going to have to be servicing them. I don't know, you know, what the numbers are of how many Disney staffers are going to be cycling in and out of there over the course of weeks and months. But those people are all at risk just going to work. And obviously they're introducing some risk into this non-bubble bubble. So I think, you know, look, there's risk no matter what they do. They're trying to minimize it. They've done, by all accounts, a very good job of planning for this. But we're in just such uncharted territory here on every single level that you can't anticipate everything, and you can't predict how this is going to unfold. And if they had to shut down again, it means something went really badly, and that thing is worse than having to stop play.
Speaking with Howard Beck from Bleacher Report. Howard, kind of further to that point, and I believe Adam Silver has already addressed this, but it's still kind of one of those what-if scenarios that continues to be thrown out there. There can't be or won't be any special rules for any certain players, i.e., knock on wood, we pray this doesn't happen, obviously. If one of the superstars of the league, if a LeBron James were to test positive and have to go into quarantine for 14 days on the eve of a conference finals, an NBA finals, or whatever, the Lakers just have to forge forward without him, correct? There's not going to be any special consideration given to certain players or certain teams.
No, this is not a time for people and their conspiracy theories and their unbridled cynicism. The NBA is obligated for all kinds of reasons, moral, ethical, health, to apply the same standard to every player. So if someone's positive for the virus, they're positive for the virus. And if testing positive means quarantine and missing a week of games or more, then that's what it means. And there's no way around that. You can't possibly risk people's lives and their health to get cute with something like that. So I know people always have their suspicions and think that you know, whether if it's LeBron or Giannis or somebody, that the rules don't apply. Like, this is not a time to be thinking that way, folks. Like, it just, the NBA could not possibly afford to do that. Now, if it comes to people leaving the bubble and wandering out into Orlando because they're you know, sick of being cooped up, and you want to say that maybe the league would turn a blind eye when it's some players rather than others, maybe? I don't know. I mean, that's going to be a real test of a lot of things here. Everyone's own self-discipline when it comes to staying in the bubble, the league's pseudo-policing of it. How are they going to determine whether somebody left? And because if they do, then when they come back, they're supposed to be quarantined. And the temptation to leave is going to be pretty high, I would think, and more so after the longer you've been there, because it's going to be tough just to be cooped up on that campus with very, you know, little contact with anybody.
Howard, you're, as I like to say, you're of a certain vintage that you would remember the NBA in days when the names on the back of uniforms weren't always surnames, as I think it was mandated by David Stern in the late 70s, early 80s, where, you know, Archie Clark had Archie on the back and Pete Maravich had Pistol on the back. And in the unique nature of this restart, players may be allowed to put social justice messages or, you know, honor people in that sense or the cause, the movement. What do you think we might see?
I don't know. I'll be curious to see how many guys avail themselves of that option, if that truly comes to pass. I think it's a potentially powerful bit of symbolism to represent somebody else, whether it's Breonna Taylor or George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or Trayvon Martin, whoever. I mean, you could, like, the list of names is depressingly long when you start to see these, you know, the list that come out recently, just kind of compiling the last 5-10 years worth of killings of unarmed black men and women. And if they wanted to, if the players wanted to make it a tribute to everyone whose names are now part of this larger cause, that's one powerful gesture. You know, nothing is going to be as powerful as the other things that the league can do in terms of the players and teams engaging with organizations and donating their time and their money. There'll be all, you know, the gestures can take on all different forms. And I assume we'll see a bit of all of that in Orlando.
Howard, why do you think over the years, and I mean, we can go back to David Stern, but certainly during Adam Silver's reign as well, why do you think that the NBA has been as open, accepting, progressive in terms of its backing and sort of companionship, allyship alongside the players to allow them to continue to have their voice, as opposed to what we've maybe seen in other sports where whether it be executives or league office commissioner themselves seem to kind of mute or try to control the message from the players much more than what the NBA does, where the NBA seems much more open to giving players and allowing players to have their platform.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the other leagues to be able to compare and contrast accurately. I've never covered, you know, Major League Baseball. I've never covered the NFL or NHL. It's sometimes hard to do this from a distance. We can only guess. But, I mean, look, football's always been very top-down and kind of authoritarian, frankly, in the way that they've run that league. And I just think that, you know, say you compare baseball to the NBA, if you consider that a lot of the activism, especially the current activism, has to do with issues that are of major concern to African Americans, and you consider that the NBA is at any given time, any given year, 75% to 80% black, it's natural that there's going to be a much bigger desire, broadly speaking, across all teams and players to want to do something and speak out at a time like this, especially than in, say, baseball, where there's you know, I don't even know what the percentage of black players is anymore, but it's shrunk over the decades.
About 8, Howard.
Yeah.
So, about 8%, yeah.
Yeah, and that's way down from where it was, you know, when we were all growing up. So I think some of this is demographics. I think some of this is just the way that these leagues have evolved in terms of the culture of the league, the relationship. You know, it's funny. People think about David Stern as having been, you know, kind of authoritarian himself, and there were moments when he was. He was certainly the disciplinarian, and he certainly would come with a hammer when it came time to negotiations for the collective bargaining agreement, but that was his job. What people often overlook is that David Stern was also a very progressive individual personally, to say nothing of, you know, what he had to do as a businessman representing the owners. But the way he always framed it, the way that the league always framed it, was that during times of labor peace, this is a partnership. And even actually during labor negotiations, it was a partnership. When you think about the whole fundamental of their split of revenues is about splitting basketball-related income, BRI. And at one time, that went up over 57%, and then they ratcheted it down to closer to 50-51 for the players. But it's a partnership. It's half the revenue to the owners, half the players. And they have generally viewed it that way. They talk about it that way. And so I think it's just an outgrowth of that the league is more supportive of players in other endeavors, whereas I don't think the other leagues view it that way.
Hey, Howard, give me your list of probably the top 5 or 6 teams you would think that would have the best chances of winning. Are there any surprises in there other than the people we look at as chalk, like, you know, Toronto, Milwaukee, Boston in the East, and then, you know, the Lakers, the Clippers, and, you know, throw a blanket over a few in the West. But do you think there are any surprises in there, or do you think we're going to see a finals coming from that group?
I'm going to give you 2 different answers, and I'm not sure which one's right. The first answer is the one that's based on where the season left off in March, which is that the Lakers and Clippers were, I think, the only true contenders in the West. There are some other good teams, but I just don't think that it was reasonable, at least as of March 11th, to think that anybody else was going to come out of the West other than the Lakers or Clippers. And in the East, as much as Milwaukee had this big lead on everybody in terms of record, I never was convinced that they were far and away better than that next tier. I thought that they were the favorites, but not runaway favorites. And I thought Boston and Toronto were the two most likely to be able to knock them off, and I wouldn't rule out, if they got right, you know, on a roll at the right time, Miami and Philadelphia are I think legitimate potential contenders. So there's the theoretical list, but that was as of March 11th. As we sit here on June 29th, who the heck knows? I mean, these teams have been off for months. These teams have been off for months. We don't know what kind of shape any individual is in. We don't know what kind of rhythm these teams will have when they come back with a short training camp and then jumping into a bunch of what I would consider basically glorified exhibitions. Like, yeah, they're going to count in the standings, and yeah, they're going to have something to do with the seeding. But those 8 games, especially against teams like Washington and Phoenix and Sacramento that have no shot at the playoffs and very little motivation and probably won't play their starters after the first couple of games or may not play their frontline players. Who knows? Basketball is going to be pretty lousy for those 8 seeding games, I think. But it's going to give the contenders or the hopeful contenders a chance to get back in rhythm. Can they get back in rhythm that quickly to the point where they're playing at a postseason type level when it's time for the playoffs to begin? I don't know. So that answer leads to this. It may be much more wide open than we would have thought on March 11th, because the teams that have the talent advantage, Lakers, Clippers, Bucks, might not have as much of an advantage once everyone's been off for months and people are just trying to just get their rhythm back.
Speaking to Howard Beck from Bleacher Report, Howard, I acknowledge in asking this, yet again, it will probably be a question where there is no definitive answer, and the best answer might be, who knows, because we really don't know. But I'm going to ask it anyways. Earlier today, on a Zoom call, a conference call, Masai Ujiri said, acknowledging his optimism and his positivity, he said that, God willing, he believes next year the NBA is playing in front of fans. The NBA is now talking about whether it's a December 1st or a December 25th start date. If we look beyond this end to the 2019-2020 season, as we sit here now on June 29th, can we even possibly think about what the 2020-2021 season might look like in terms of when it starts? Are there fans? Are teams hopscotching all over North America as regular? How does next season look as we sit here in the middle of 2020?
Yeah, obviously impossible to answer. On my podcast later this afternoon, I'm taping with a couple of epidemiologists who I've had on once before, and I'm going to throw that question at them, and they will probably have a little bit more to say than I can because they're experts and I'm not. But my guess is that their answer will be much the same, which is, who knows where we will be as a society in December or January. And look, Dr. Fauci has said recently that he thinks that a vaccine could be here by the end of the year or in January. But having a vaccine and having it mass produced and mass distributed are two different things. And I think that you need the vaccine is a prerequisite to having fans back in buildings, or at least full buildings. And so I think next season starts without fans. I'm curious to whether or not next season starts in home markets or not, because now you're introducing travel back into the equation. It's no longer a bubble. Like, are we far enough along in December that we can have teams playing in their home markets again and traveling? I think that's even a question before we even get to whether or not fans can be in the building.
Well, Howard, it just hit me there. We used to always bump into each other in New York, and either in Brooklyn or MSG, and have a chance to sit down and chat about everything. And then we'd take a 10-minute segment like this and put it on the air. And it just makes you wonder, when the heck are we getting back to anything that resembles close to what we used to before? And if we don't, how does that change the landscape going forward for, never mind all of us in the media? I mean, as Eric said, we did a 42-person Zoom call today with Masai Ujiri and Fred VanVleet. What happens to the people that work in these arenas and the parking lots that depend on these jobs? Like, what does that do to the economy? I mean, it's crazy.
I know. And that's just our little piece of the world, right? Like, that's right. Our little bubbles. We see, we see the ticket takers and the ushers and parking lot attendants and locker room attendants. And all of a sudden you think about how many people are affected, and then, expand out. And of course, people working in restaurants and bars and everything else, it's just tough for everybody. And I wish we could all be back in those arenas, schmoozing before game time and chit chatting with scouts and GMs and each other and all that. That feels like it's a long ways in our rearview mirror already, and it feels like it could be a long way off in our future too. Look, obviously we're going to get through this. At some point there will be a vaccine, and at some point we will all be able to resume some sense of normalcy. But the worst thing possible is for people to start rushing back before we can actually do this safely. And we've already seen that all over this country, where cases are spiking because they reopened economies too quickly. And people, part of this is just human nature. Oh, okay, the lockdown's over. Great. We're back to normal. But, and no social distancing and no wearing masks and people just acting like idiots and just being ignorant of how dangerous this thing still is and how prominent it still is. And so, I'm trying not to get too far ahead of myself when it comes to resuming whatever is normal for the NBA, because we have so many other steps we have to take before we even get to that just as a society.
Howard, we appreciate the time, the insights today. Thanks for doing this. Look forward to chatting again soon. But in the meantime, stay safe and healthy, and all the best to you and your family.
You guys as well. Great chatting with you guys. Thanks.
Good to talk, Howard.
There is Howard Beck from Bleacher Report. We'll take the break, come back, and shift our attention from basketball to baseball. Ben Wagner up next on Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. On Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you, joining us on the line right now. One of the voices of the Toronto Blue Jays right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Blue Jays broadcaster Ben Wagner. Ben, how you doing today?
Doing well. Excited about the potential of baseball coming north of the border. That really has me excited.
Yes. Fingers are certainly crossed, and I guess that's where we should start, Ben. I mean, last we heard, we're still awaiting official confirmation from the Canadian government that this can indeed or will indeed happen. But I guess the prospect is the Blue Jays all coming north, 58-man roster for a training camp before the regular season begins, and then 30 regular season games being played in Toronto. How do you feel about that plan, that proposal, and how it kind of best fits or suits the Blue Jays specifically, Ben?
Well, right now, I feel sorry for Mark Shapiro and Ross Adkins, honestly, because they are trying to mobilize on two fronts. One, having a truck down the street here in Dunedin, Florida. And for those listeners that don't know, my home base now is where the Blue Jays have spring training. So in the off season, I come down to Dunedin, Florida. This has been the spot where I've been planted since spring training 1.0. or spring training as we knew it before summer training arrives. Since the middle of March, I have not moved. So I have been in the ups and downs and now the wildfire that is COVID across a lot of the southeastern states, and Florida being a major talking point there. And that's where the Blue Jays are trying to get rid of a lot of the concern that you have in this state and the community contact points that are around this state absolutely running rampant, trying to remove their players and coaches and personnel out of that. That's one front. The other thing, if the Canadian government doesn't approve the plan the Major League Baseball and the Blue Jays have presented, and we should get some clarification either today or within the next day or two, then they have to shift gears and Dunedin becomes the home base, and they will try to intensify that bubble as much as they can. Now, that's just trying to get to day one of what is Major League Baseball and their camps opening up, scheduled between July 1st and July 3rd for most of the major league teams that are having report dates out there. And then you got to go through 3 weeks and hope that players, coaches, support staff all behave themselves and isolate as much as possible so you can even get this thing off the ground. And oh, by the way, then you get to a regular season that should be in 60 games and about 66 to 70 dates. That's a lot to ask. So this is just scratching the surface of what it will take to even accomplish a season. Personally, I'm stunned we're at this point. I thought maybe the Biodome would work early in the talks, but as we saw this virus just absolutely cripple economies, states or provinces or pockets of a province, you know, it looks like sports is trying to drive the bus here and get people some normalcy in their day and some form of entertainment. As we know, many regions in Ontario is doing a great job. I understand that. But, you know, a lot of where these games are set to unfold, they're absolutely spinning their wheels right now trying to get a hold of this thing.
Hey, Jonesy, let me just jump in for 1 second here before you follow up. I didn't know if you saw this, Paul, and I'm mentioning it to Ben as well, but Doug Ford just mentioned minutes ago in a press conference, and this is a direct quote, "I've been in conversation with Mark Shapiro all weekend. He's just waiting for the letter of support from the federal government. There's a few tweaks here at the province that the doctors want to work out with him." So that's, again, the latest within the last, like, less than 5 minutes from Doug Ford.
Well, and Eric, to that point, Ben, In your answer with Eric and your last statement, you used a word in there that behave. And I see a sect of the population exercising, you know, constitutional freedom, saying, you know what? I have the right to go out. I'm going to go out. I have the right to go out without wearing a mask. I'm going to do that. And I mean, it's become a huge discussion. Eric and I have touched on it here. You know, to me, is a mask at this point going to be like seatbelts in the 60s and 70s, where people are like, you don't need one. And people say, well, yeah, you should wear one just in case. And then eventually now it's become what it is now. You have to wear a seatbelt. What behaviors do you see that people have to change? Because maybe it's not just the mask, but there are other things that have to be kind of tweaked before baseball, sports, and eventually society can go forward.
Well, I think it starts on the large scale, and that is society. We have to do better for our individuals. We have to do better for the greater good here, and we have to understand the importance of social distancing. You know, yesterday afternoon is a prime example. I took two steps out of my door. I looked down at the pool area, and on a normal Saturday or Sunday afternoon, you would expect a pool area to be absolutely jam-packed on a hot summer day. Sure. In this situation, what I saw was really concerning. Where I live, like feet from my door, and it was an overcrowded pool, people horsing around, jumping and splashing around. And this is a community which has a lot of good-natured people in it and very friendly people in it. But this is the point where our friendliness has to stop the length of a hockey stick away. This is where we have to have a better awareness of the people that are around and what we're doing for those people. And I think that's where it starts. You players, coaches, people in personnel are used to, and behind the scenes personnel are used to taking instruction and following rules. Now, sometimes those rules are loosened a little bit, you know, when they're not in the corridor of a ballpark or an arena. And you are allowed to have some of those freedoms. But in this case, to get it done, those freedoms are going to have to be removed. And you have to, unfortunately, sacrifice, I think, for the greater good here. And wearing a mask is part of that. And I am a proponent of wearing a mask. I think it should be worn in proximity where you're not able to self-distance. I try to do that as socially responsible as I'm able to. And I think the Blue Jays, I know the Blue Jays are hammering that point home. And it started from the moment that Mark Shapiro and Charlie Montoyo stood in front of the room of players in the middle of March when spring training was shut down. I think the gravity of the situation really sank into a lot of the players. And some of those players even voiced their concern, understanding that they're going home to a place where they have people that are susceptible to this virus and at risk, whether it's an elderly parent or grandparent that they're closely connected to, or even one of their children that might have defects. Look no further than where the manager sits and Charlie Montoyo and what his family has had to deal with and their son Alex over the years with his heart condition.
Speaking with Ben Wagner, Jay's broadcaster right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, I'm just going to go reference again another comment, and maybe it's just kind of a further expansion of the quote I read moments ago, but Ontario Premier Doug Ford and Shai Davidi tweeted this one out, saying, quote, that the Blue Jays Major League Baseball plan, just pending federal government approval, quote, on the quarantine side of things. He continues to say, quote, I know all the municipal, provincial, and federal health folks kind of gave their approval, but then again added, Ontario looking for a few tweaks. Ben, we could talk baseball specifically, and I'm sure you'd probably prefer to do that and talk about the names on the 58 men that have been invited to come to camp when things ultimately do resume. But just on a personal level, I know Jonesy has family down in Florida, but being there, and you just kind of gave us a brief glimpse, what has it been like, aside from just earlier this morning, the folks in the pool, on a daily basis, when you're trying to just go about your daily life, whether you're going to a store, whether you're going for a walk, what is it like in Florida? Because we are not exempt from criticism here in Ontario or in Canada, but it certainly sounds like, and the numbers just are fact alone, it is far worse in Florida, far worse in major pockets in the U.S. than what it is right here.
It's been uncomfortable for me, and it's uncomfortable really over the course of all of it, which is really unfortunate. When you started to see the rules laxed and the phases rolled out, it was clear that Florida was going to be aggressive in trying to get economy and tourism and a lot of the drivers that make this state function. They were going to be very aggressive and try to get that off the ground. And it is now its demise, where it has gone from a gradual uptick to an absolute forest fire. When you look at where, from last week alone, the numbers have skyrocketed. And, you know, I'm knocking on the door of 40 years of age here. And a lot of the new cases and the concerning case numbers are in that demographic. When you look at the 20s, the 30s, and the 40-year-olds, after initially it was thought to be an elderly population that would have been the highest target here, it's almost like those people have kind of disappeared into the background and sheltered, which they should have, and now they clearly need to do because of what's happening outside the cocoon that I'm in. It's very unnerving. And I'm taking every precaution that I can personally to go through my day-to-day life with the opportunity for me to have my job come back into my lap and sit in the studio, or hopefully if Rogers Center is allowed to host games this year, you know, we can have some Blue Jays baseball unfolding in front of us at the same time. So my senses are extremely heightened in this, and I'm trying to isolate myself as much as possible, one, so I can return to the job, but also I just don't want to put anybody at risk whatsoever.
Ben, when you've talked to people about the actual execution of the game itself, how do you see that happening in a way that, as you have just put it there, not doesn't put anybody else at risk, doesn't put players at risk around first base or, you know, who's handling the ball? And I know they've talked about, you know, on a strikeout, you don't throw the ball around the infield. There's little things like that where you see are subtle changes that are made to try and help keep the participants, the players free. Because I'm sure if you're uncomfortable, there's guys that are playing the game that are uncomfortable too.
This is going to be a total adjustment from what everybody that is on that diamond has done or conducted themselves since they probably put on the ball cap for the first time in Pee Wee's or Little League or T-ball, where you're in the batter's box, you try to adjust yourself, get comfortable, and all of a sudden a bead of sweat is dripping down into your eye. What do? You immediately reach up for your face and try to flick it away. Well, now you're flicking a bead of sweat or perspiration or spit, whatever that's hanging on your lip. You're flicking that away. What if it lands on the umpire or the catcher? Like, the entire game, and I've seen the 102-page document. It is very boring to read. It outlines so many things that are in some ways you didn't even think of. And in a lot of ways, you're thinking, my gosh, how are they going to pull this off? You know, not only in spring training, but over the course of 60 games, and are players really going to be able to conduct the game this way? There are some of those nuances that are just mind-boggling, and it'll be very interesting to see if some of these things can come to fruition and players can get by it, you know. But you're going to have contact. You're going to have a guy diving back to first base on a pickoff play, and all of a sudden, you know, the throw's a little wild, and the first baseman's going to land on top of the base runner. Those things are just going to happen. So it'll be very interesting within the confines of the game to see how it is structured, how it's enforced, or if there are reminders given. I think it's definitely going to take some time to get used to from a player perspective.
Hey, Ben, we appreciate the time, as always. Thanks for doing this, and fingers crossed that, you know, things can get back to normal or as close to normal as possible on this side of the border from a Jays perspective, again, with the caveat being as long as it's safe and proper to do so. All the best, and look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Yeah, really encouraging news, it sounds like, today, and I can't wait to get back into the GTA and have some Blue Jays baseball in front of us. Thank you so much, guys. Stay safe.
All right,
thanks, Ben.
There is Ben Wagner, Jays broadcaster, right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We'll take the break, come back, and get set to wrap things up on another edition of Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Back on Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. Jonesy, Colin Kaepernick signs a one-year deal with the New England Patriots, or excuse me, Cam Newton. I was just reading an article on Colin Kaepernick. I think folks wish that Colin Kaepernick would be back. I apologize. It's Cam Newton, of course, signing the one-year deal with the New England Patriots. And the reason I bring this up as well is I know that you're a fan of Cam Newton's game. Kind of strange how things ultimately unfolded with Carolina. But only one other team considered even the possibility of signing Newton, and it was your club, the Cleveland Browns, but it never even got to a point where they offered a deal. Only one team across the National Football League actually wanting to or willing to sign Cam Newton, and it's the New England Patriots.
Well, to me, that's we could do a whole show on this. It's a bit of a joke that
yes.
a former MVP has that happen. And two, for me, it's a definition of mixed emotions. That's like watching somebody you hate steal your car and drive over the cliff in it. You know, anybody but New England. But hey, the guy's got a job. Good for him. I hope he does well and makes himself some money.
All right. Back tomorrow with another edition of Smith and Jones.